The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry with Joe McGill.
Good morning. How are you this morning? I'm Joe McGill and you're listening to the Saturday Supplement. And I hope I find you well wherever you are listening to us around the world on RadioKerry.ie, on the Radio Kerry app, or on the traditional wireless 96 to 98 FM. It is a glorious morning in the kingdom this morning. And I got up this morning and it's the first time in a long time I had to go back in and get a bit of water to clear the screen because the amount of frost that was on the windscreen, but the fields were bathing in this beautiful, almost like you'd call it cotton frost. And that has been rising this morning with the heat. It started off, my journey was 1 degree, and when I finished the journey it was 7 degrees, and that's why you have a lot of this mist around this morning as well. But when that clears off, it's going to be beautiful. But just be careful when you are driving. There's a bit of frost and there's also that bit of fog, as you would have heard on the wonderful Abigail Bernard's programme this morning. I was listening to the news there, the stone skimming championships in Scotland, and how people are filing their stones to get a competitive advantage. Man, when you introduce competition to anything, doesn't it get very serious? It was something I could never really master, was the skimming of the stone. I'd get about 3 or 4. But there were some of my friends that could skim it for miles, and it'd just dance along the water. But it was all about picking the right stone, so I can see why people file their stones. A lot of work when you're throwing the stone away. It didn't like you can go back and retrieve it. Although I had a dog, still have a dog, that would try and retrieve the stone for you. Now, very busy programme on the Saturday Supplement this morning. As always, if you want to get in touch with us, you can call us on 066-712-3666. Dervla is taking your calls. You can text the WhatsApp 083-300-3300. On the programme on the Saturday Supplement this morning, we'll be speaking to Shane Lahan, UCC folklorist and author of Old Ways, New Days, Ireland Remembered. He will be on to tell us about Easter traditions of the past. John G. O'Dwyer will talk about Pilgrim Paths Week, which takes place from the 4th to the 12th of April, and that's including a few of the paths in this county. We'll also hear from Tralee woman Fiona Quirk about her experience of surviving cancer 3 times. And I will also be remembering the late, great Ronnie Delaney by playing excerpts of an interview I did with the legendary athlete in 2017. But first, I always look forward to having this man on. Shane Lahan, author of Old Ways, New Days, Ireland Remembered, is on the line. Shane, you're very welcome to the programme. How are you this morning?
I'm just like yourself, Joe. I'm looking out here at a beautiful, frosty morning and the sun layering in. Isn't it a joy? I think we're doubling on our appreciation of it.
Yeah, I think we skipped spring and went straight to summer there. It's like we've just come out of the winter and galloped forward. The book I mentioned, Shane, how's it gone for you? You were on to talk to us there a while back.
Well, Joe, I must say, I've got a wonderful response from it. I was signing books for Christmas and for people, and I was delighted. It sold out, Joe, which was great.
Whoa.
And the publishers have gone back and they've done a reprint, so it's back in the shops. And I kind of noticed that it's in some shops, so get people out asking for it, because that's the best way to get it. Because sometimes when it's not on the shelf, people are wondering, where is it, you know? So
yeah.
I know, I'm delighted with it, Joe. It's lovely, you know. It's not about sales or anything. It's just a celebration of all of the wonderful people I've met through time, and reminiscences and memories, and anybody who's read it, they come back to me now with a new yarn and a new story and a new element. So for me, it's just a vehicle that I can collect more stuff, you know?
Yeah, it's also a wonderful way of preserving our past. It's a wonderful looking book. Just to synopsize what's in the book again for people if they've just heard about it.
Yeah, so listen, Joe, it's kind of, there's a few little bits to it, you know, but one of the things I love is that it's not just about, you know, the ancient past or the 18th century, 19th century, 20th century stuff. It brings us from all of that, from everything to do with the wakes long ago and to do with marriage customs long ago and even birthing and all of that. But I brought it in as well, Joe, up to the coming of things like the bicycle and the coming of electricity and television and radio. So it kind of goes from that early part right up to the present day, because our folk customs and our traditions and our stories that we tell each other, they belong to us just up to the present. So, and what I love about it is that I managed to get in, you know, when you're writing something academically, you can't really include the funny story. Well, this is full of funny stories. It's full of all the stuff that you normally can't say. So I love that then.
Well, you're on this morning to talk about Easter, and like this commemorates the resurrection of Jesus Christ and is a major event in the Christian calendar. It marks the end of the Lenten season of fasting. And we should say as well, the Sunday that came a week before Easter Sunday was known as Palm Sunday, where Palm is blessed in the church and taken home. Now, like everything, I suppose, Shane, it has become very commercialised in the last few years, and 'tis all nearly about Easter eggs as much as anything else, but eggs have played a part always.
Yeah, listen, I actually think this is the season of eggs, Joe, and I was thinking about what will I talk about this morning, but we should take our time because there's so many things to talk about. But eggs throughout, you know, we pancake night throughout Tuesday, one of the things you were doing is that you were using up all the eggs that you possibly could have, because the egg was forbidden throughout the 40 days of Lent. You couldn't eat any eggs. And it was also the time, you see, when you were kind of getting rid of any hens that weren't laying or anything like that. So it kind of made a lot of sense to kind of, this was the turning point of the year. Like, was it yesterday is the equinox or today? We're in that sort of period of change. And everything is going to be reborn, of course, in harmony with the whole Christian concept of Christ. As Easter time and the resurrection. So it was so interesting for me. But during this time of the year now, as we come up towards Easter, the kids would be going around, all the young who were not eating eggs and so on. But there'd be some hens, of course, still laying. So you kept them laying, but nobody could eat them. And quite often they used to butter the outside of the egg to kind of seal it off, to kind of preserve it.
Whoa.
But the young children would come along and they'd be saying, give me my cludog, as it was called, okay? And sometimes a prochog, and that was the name that was given to the eggs that were collected. And especially, you know, coming up to, like from Good Friday onwards and Easter Saturday and so on, they'd be knocking at doors with a big stocking and they'd be collecting these eggs, you know, and the housewife, the Banantee, would be delighted to get rid of them, of course, you know. But what they were doing is that they were going to have a really big special feast, the cludog. And it was kind of like they would all sit around together, they'd find a little spot. Sometimes if people were kind of helpful, they'd make a kind of a camp, let's say, out in the corner of a field or something like that. And there would usually be a kind of a responsible kind of older boy or an adolescent or a girl who would look after them. And they would light a fire because there was no point in boiling the eggs that time. That was too difficult. But they used to actually roast the eggs for their egg feast on Easter Sunday. And this was the big, big event. And everyone looked forward to this like nothing else. And it was the quantity of eggs you had to eat that was important, you know. And you know, it's a bit like the pancakes on Shrove Tuesday. Like everyone would be saying, how many pancakes did you eat and so on. Well, the same went, Joe, for the eggs, you know. And it was people famous. Like people were being known for eggs. I remember I came across an account in Tipperary from a place called Curraclooney. And there was a lady there called Nari Noonan. And she was still famous years afterwards because on Easter Sunday she had 21 hen's eggs and one goose egg. And she lived well into her 90s, you know. So it was like your reputation would be made on Easter Sunday, you know. But it was gas, you know. But Junior Crean, you know, the great Junior Crean up in Bonneville and County Clare, is a great fiddle player. I remember reading an account from him. He was saying that, like, young and old used to eat the egg, but he said, Jesus, he says afterwards, you'd want a gas mask, he said.
As well. I was about to say, you would want to be downwind of any of these.
But there was a whole interesting kind of sight as well. They used to, when they'd eat the eggs, the shells would be taken up, and I was listening to you there, you were saying you were skimming stones, but they used to put them up on top of a wall, Joe, and then they'd be taking stones at the eggshells. You know, there was a whole pile of fun and games with the eggs. Like sometimes you have a game a little bit like Conkers, you know, someone would have an egg, like there's a collection of eggs, you see, and you'd tap one egg against the other, and if your egg stayed solid and the shell broke, you could take their egg, you know, and you were accumulating, you were bringing up. So everything, like we think about the chocolate eggs now, the commercial side of it on Easter Sunday. And I mean, as a child, we all loved, and I can see them in the shops today. But in the past, people forget that this was all about real eggs, you know. Yeah. And most importantly, the most important time for the eggs, funny enough, was Good Friday. And Good Friday eggs had a massive significance altogether in Ireland. And people waited for the hen to lay the first egg on Good Friday. That was a big, big deal. And they used to market specially. They'd get a little bit of a stick and maybe stick it into the fire like a piece of charcoal and put a cross on it. And then what would happen with that was that, especially if it was a black hen that laid it, right, that would be great altogether. And then they would keep that. And that on Easter Sunday then was the first egg that was eaten by all the family. And they would all take a little bit of it because people felt that on that day, that would give you health and give you, you know, strength for the rest of the year. But the resurrection, if you like, going from the Good Friday, from the crucifixion, to the egg being the regenerative, the symbol of regeneration, if you like, it was a huge, huge, huge part of things, you know?
Yeah, we had a student, she works in Radio Care now on our broadcasting course, Yulia from Ukraine, and she was talking about the Easter traditions around eggs there where they had the egg art. So it's not just in Ireland that the egg was kind of, you know, such a huge thing coming up to Easter.
Oh no! And listen, we decorated our eggs as well, Joe. Mm. And we had all very clever ways of colouring them. Onion skins were the main source of dye. You know, if you had a yellow onion, it used to give you, I think, with a reddish or a brown, it would be dark. You know, and sometimes what they would do is they'd put like something like a primrose might be out this time of the year, or a fern, and you'd put it onto the side of the egg. And what would happen is that when you were dyeing it, then and you took it out, you could peel that off, and you'd get the imprint of the flower on the egg. You know, and red onions that we have now, they're very popular now, but they were sought out especially because they would give actually a light blue colour to the egg. Beetroot would give you a dark red, and spinach, green. And you remember long ago as well, you had a thing called blue. You'd often put it into the whitewash to make it a bit brighter or whatever, or the clothes, the bed clothes and the linens and so on. But that would be used as well. So, and then they'd have all sorts of lichens and mosses to do stuff. So, like, the art of dyeing eggs was something that Ireland had a really strong pedigree in as well, but not as much as the beautiful Ukrainian eggs. And I tell you, I have a lovely student as well, though, that you mentioned, Alina, one of my lovely Ukrainian students. And one of the most beautiful things she gave me was a gorgeous painted Ukrainian egg, a wooden one. And I have it on my desk inside and work, you know, so yeah. You're quite right.
They're stunning. I'm looking at photos of them here. They're absolutely unbelievable. Shane, stay with us. We'll go to a break and we'll have more from Shane Lehan after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shop and Seafood Bar, the Mall Tralee. Treat yourself to the freshest takeaway fish and chips today, right in the heart of Tralee.
Yeah, Shane Lehan, UCC folklorist and author of Always New Days, Ireland Remembered, is on with us this morning. And that book, Always New Days, Ireland Remembered, is in the shops again now after a real successful first run. And we're talking about Easter traditions. And Shane, at the start of Lent, I talked to the people at home about the lentil kind of observations that were there in the past, and they were quite draconian and strict, and they've changed a lot to nowadays, to what you kind of maybe give up a few sweets and things or sugar or something. But Good Friday was the culmination and coming out of all that, and there was amazing traditions around Good Friday, wasn't there?
There was. And just to say, double on this, you know, Lent was really observed long ago, Joe. You know, there was no dancing, there was no cinema, there was no cards were taken off. They used to burn the deck of cards so that nobody could play, you know.
Whoa, and, I didn't know that. Yeah.
And they'd give up they get a new deck of cards then at Easter. But you're quite right, of all the days that was really focused then for Lent was Good Friday. And, you know, there were so many things going on. People were cleaning up the house, they were getting everything ready for Easter, you know. I remember being young, we always got a new rig out for Easter. We always got new clothes, you know. I always remember my mother bringing us in, and we got new shoes, and you know, and you were brought into Mass then on Easter, like kind of just like a parade, like of people, you know, going on. But just going back to the Good Friday, there were so many things that you did on Good Friday then to get ready, if you like. And one thing was to have your hair cut. The most popular day in Ireland to have your hair cut was on Good Friday, because anything that was starting anew and getting ready, and if you like, you're going to be reborn or rejuvenated. The girls would always wash their hair, and then it would be, and they'd have a cut, and it would be twice as thick and twice as long, if you like, on for the rest of the year. But they also did it because it was the one day in the year that the girls and the women would go into the church with their hair down, because we have a huge tradition in Ireland of keening the dead, or of lamenting the dead, and mostly the girls would have their hair up, or they would have it covered with a scarf or a mantilla and so on. But you would have your hair on show as a sign of the mourning of Christ after the crucifixion. So there was a great deal to do with hair. One thing I love is that a lot of fellas who were bald long ago, Joe, you know, they often thought that the baldness came from the flitch of bacon up in the rafters dripping down on top of their head. You know, if you were sitting by the fire, that they thought the bald patch came from that. And there's a nice little link in with that, because you always took the bacon that was hanging up down on Good Friday, because it was seen, it was like Christ was being crucified. The bacon, the meat up in the rafters, if you like, was almost the symbol of the same thing. So there was that connection there as well. Yeah. And when you think about it, you weren't allowed to use no blacksmith, no carpenters. You couldn't drive a nail on Good Friday. You couldn't cut anything with a saw. No wood was to be there. No boats went to sea. And, you know, there was all of those sort of
things. And was the nail to do with the cross, is it?
Yeah. See, so Christ was nailed on the cross. So
you couldn't,
I was doing it because today I was talking about it. The robin seemingly tried to do his very best to take the nails out when Christ was being crucified, and that's why he's got the red breast. But the other story was that didn't the magpie find them and bring them back? And that's, of course, why we hate the magpie, because he was the fellow to bring the nails back, you know?
Mm.
But another thing that's interesting is that you planted things then, Joe, as well, on Good Friday. Spuds were always planted, okay? You could plant them between Paddy's Day, Patrick's Day on the 17th, the early ones, and they'd be ready by, believe it or not, by the 12th of July. Billy, you plant with King, plant with Paddy, and dig with Billy. That used to be the phrase, right? Let go. But they put down what they call putting down an early pot. If you went down and if you planted on Good Friday, everything would be good. Your oats, if you sowed them on Good Friday, they would never rot, you know. And there was always a sense, and in particular, funnily enough, garlic. Garlic was the day to plant your garlic, was on Good Friday. And that was ready then between the 15th of August, which is the Assumption, and the Immaculate Conception, which is the 8th. And over those periods of time, you would consume that garlic then that was planted on Good Friday, and you consume it in goat's milk. I get on to Shawnee now, and we get some goat's milk there.
You have the cousin there, yeah.
we between the pair of us now, we could go into a little business there, because that was the definite cure for consumption or coughs and colds that you'd have coming into the winter then, you see. That was the part of it.
Yeah.
But there was so much to about, when I'm thinking about it now, a child born on Good Friday was always baptized then on Easter Sunday, and they always then had incredible powers and good. And in fact, nearly everyone thought if you were born on Good Friday and you were baptized on Easter Sunday, you went straight into the priesthood then. Okay, that was kind of a... But the other thing is that you might have a cure as well. And particularly people long ago, there was lots of tapeworm and that kind of stuff going on. A child who was baptized would have a worm put into their hand when they were being baptized, and then they would always have the cure for tapeworm and so on. So there was massive significance to the day altogether.
And how do people have any time to do anything on Good Friday? It sounds like your day would be packed from dawn till dusk, get away with everything, and then you have to do the Stations of the Cross as well.
You did, and you had two Stations of the Cross, and you know, there was between 12 o'clock and 3 o'clock then was the time really of the 12 o'clock was the crucifixion and 3 o'clock was the time of Christ dying. And that was a very solemn period altogether. Mm. And people did not, and you wouldn't eat anything. And many people never ate anything. It was a black fast day. You were allowed, there was no milk being drunk, black tea if you were lucky. And you might have a small collation, which was a little biscuit. I was telling people there, Joe, that up in Cork, they had a great thing here. We had a bishop here one time, Connie Lucy, and Bishop Lucy. He was a bit of a tyrant in his own day and so on. And everyone heard that you could only have a tea and two collations on the day. Mm. And of course, Cork people didn't know what a collation was, so they asked the bishop, and the bishop said, "Oh, that'd be something like about the size of a little biscuit," he said. Like that. So the size of a biscuit. So what happened in a number of the bakeries around Cork, they started making these gigantic biscuits, things with fill a plate. And they were known then as the Connie Dodger. The Connie Dodger was the Dodge Connie Lucy's proclamation. So they were a big part of it, yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely amazing the traditions we have in this country, you know, that have developed over years, and then that there's remnants of them still here today. Fish was a big part, and the herring as well, and whipping the herring and all this, yeah. And that's kind of a Cork thing as well, is it?
There is, and in fact, it's a European thing, believe it or not, Joe, because the herring was the one. During Lent, of course, fish became everything, and actually on Good Friday, what they called the bia thra, which was the shore fish, if you like, you would be picking periwinkles, and you'd be picking, anything you could, limpets and so on. All of that. That would be what you would eat on Good Friday in particular. And there's a lovely, know that given where you are, there's a lovely tradition actually of between Skellig and Lent, because if you were only eating fish, there were a number of things that you could cheat. And one was that people thought the Barnacle goose, the goose was, they thought because it looked like the barnacles, when you see them, they look like a goose's head. They thought that they actually originated from the sea, and therefore you could eat a goose around Lenten time. And the other thing that people thought was, of course, the puffins. And one of the reasons why people started going to Skellig, and we have this whole business of the Skellig lists and all of that sort of idea, came about because people were actually going off catching puffins, and they used to salt the puffins, and they believed, because they were out at sea most of the time, that they were fish and not fowl, and they were a Lenten, something you eat during Lent as well. So there's incredible traditions. But the herring, let's just go back. Herrings are amazing. Herring, Jane, Max, like herring is lovely every now and again, but if you got a herring for 40 days, you'd be absolutely sick to death of it. And who was particularly sick of it were the butchers, because the butchers sold no meat for the entire 40 days of Lent. So what do they do is they had a great celebration on Easter Sunday, and that was literally the what they call the herring funerals or the herring processions. And they used to put up a big side of lamb up on top of an old pike as meat days are here again. And from that then, they hanging from that as well, they used to have a little the herring. And there was a fellow who would go after it, and he'd have a little whip, and he was whipping the herring and saying, "Well, we're sick of you in a way, that we don't want to eat you now anymore." Absolutely huge. So there was a huge, great sense of festivity on Easter Sunday. And there was cake dances. There were people started to, you know, this was like coming out of that period of tremendous sort of, and people did it, you see. We're all kind of here saying no, but people really did adhere to Lent before. So when you came out of it, Joe, the feast that you had on Easter Sunday was something else.
Yeah, you'd be well sick of eggs after it, I'd say as well. the cake dance you mentioned, there's the dance of the sun then, that on Easter Sunday morning, that it was believed the sun would dance in the sky on Easter Sunday morning. But you mentioned the lamb there. Was lamb always a thing for Easter Sunday? Because, you know, we traditionally think of it Easter Sunday, spring lamb, that's a thing you'd have.
Yeah, exactly. And just before I take, we should say to people, there is this lovely tradition. I love the idea of the sun dancing in the sky, and that's it. But you shouldn't, unlike Mr. Trump, you shouldn't be looking at it directly. Okay, the way that you should do it actually is that people used to often get a dish of water or the bucket of water, we'll say, inside the door, and you would look at the sun through the reflection. And of course, if you think about it, then Joe, there would always be a little ripple on the water surface, you know, and you get that sense of the sun moving and dancing. And I love that sort of idea. But going back,
The lamb.
Sorry, I've forgotten what you were asking. The lamb. Of course, you see, we must remember that we think about Bridget and we think about Bridget's Day and so on. I always say to my students that if we didn't interfere whatsoever with the natural gestation and of animals and the time from conception to birth and so on, that nearly all this, that from February the new lambs are born. And it comes to a point where you naturally then have a time to cull those because, you know, you'll want to keep a certain number and you don't want a load of rams and so on. So, and of course we always eat animals before they're mature because that's when they're the most succulent and so on. And apologies now to the vegetarians listening, but my point is that if you are eating something, you eat something young and it's at the perfect time. And that's really why lamb comes into it. Later on, Joe, mutton is quite a different thing. And mutton was known, believe it or not, as spoiling. Spoiling was fairly tough. And there's lots of very funny stories about fellas, you know, with very little teeth, tugging away all day long at a bit of spoiling. And they kind of, you know, gnashing their teeth into it and ripping and tearing it and trying to swallow the thing. So on. So lamb definitely was the best of the meat, you know. Mm. And you're not killing a big animal. You're killing a small animal, and you know, you've got that notion. And then of course you've got the whole Paschal lamb idea, you've got the shepherd, you've got all these traditions kind of mingling into people's minds. So it's the logical choice.
Yeah, but doesn't it, like, and I don't want to be like all nostalgic and happy on that the old days were best, but like wasn't there a lot more to it? You know, you came on here before and you talked about Christmas, you talk about Halloween, the amount of effort that people made and the traditions that were handed down, they were such a part of our identity. And now it's just about chocolate eggs on a Sunday, you know, like there was a lot more to it, wasn't there?
There was, and I just feel too, Joe, you know, those patterns, and I love that word, the patterns by which we lived in the past. There was, you know, yesterday, just had Eid and we had the end of Ramadan, and it was just beside the college where I'm teaching, there was a big, big gang of people. They were all so excited. And there was this notion that, but you know, the notion of us taking time out and maybe reflecting a bit and maybe not having ice cream every day and not having sweets every day and strawberries when we want them all year round and so on. We were in a time of season and we were in a time of you know, it's good to, you know, people go on diets and so on. They do all sorts of things. But they were kind of built into our traditions as well in the past.
Yeah.
They were built into, and when everybody was doing it, it made us even more festive then, because you know you were observing it. And I even remember as a child, like, we used to go off the sweets and we'd have our tin of sweets and we'd be saving them up, and you know, that was like our, you know, so it there is a sort of a rationale into us thinking about how every day is Christmas Day now, you know.
Yeah.
Every day is a good, so it's very hard to, you know, you need to have the good and the bad, you need to have the lean and the full, you know.
Yeah. Shane, an absolute pleasure as always. You're a font of knowledge, and I'm delighted to hear that the book went so well and is going so well, and it's in all good bookshops. Old Ways, New Days, Ireland Remembered. Shane, thanks a million for coming on, and I look forward to speaking to you again.
Thanks, Joe. Best of luck to everyone. Bye-bye.
Now, we're going to take a break, and after that, we're going to be talking to John G. O'Dwyer about Pilgrim Paths Week, which is taking place from the 4th to the 12th of April.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's The Mad Monk in Killarney. Serving the finest seafood in a cosy, modern atmosphere. Book your special experience today at seafoodbar.ie.
That's what you listen to, and get in touch with us on 066-712-3666. Dervla is taking your calls. You can text the WhatsApp 083-300-3300. Now, the Pilgrim Paths Week is taking place from the 4th to the 12th of April. And I'm delighted to say, joining us now We have John G. O'Dwyer, whose Irish walks have become famous through his column in the Irish Times and his several books, and he has been on this programme a good few times as well, which we always enjoy having him on. John, you're very welcome this morning. How are you?
Thank you very much for the invite to come on once again.
I tell you, if you were walking today or you were going out, and I know you're always walking, it would be absolutely spectacular, because the distance you can see from some of these walks would be amazing, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Well, you see, what you get is sometimes in very warm weather in summer, you get a sort of a haze where you don't see things so well. We had up here, you wouldn't know what that is down there in Kerry. We actually had a bit of frost this morning. Yeah. But that's used for a lovely, crisp, clear day. And I was out around this morning. Beautiful.
So tell us about the Pilgrim Paths Week. How did it originate?
Well, it originated because what was happening was all the groups, there was all these groups who were very proud of their own, about 10 years ago, they were proud of their own pilgrim path. But there was no coordination between any one of them. So then in 2013, it originated from the setting up of Pilgrim Paths Ireland, which brought all the groups together so that, you know, as they say, Níl Niartna go Cordula Céile. So they all came together and formed Pilgrim Paths Ireland, and out of that then initially came Pilgrim Paths Day, but there's so many paths around now, it then became Pilgrim Paths Week, and it's at Easter when people probably are most receptive to the message that comes from the Pilgrim Paths, and it was decided to have it at Easter.
Yeah, because I know one Pilgrim Path down Connachtna Dubber, they actually do the Stations of the Cross on Good Friday, so that's around this time, isn't it? That we're talking about.
It is. That would be part of that walk. They go up along there. That would be part of the Pilgrim Paths walk. And that's a tradition. They do that every year. And of course, Connachtna Dubber down there, I've been on the top of quite a lot of mountains in Ireland. And I would say myself that Connachtna Dubber, there are two viewpoints that I think are really outstanding. And one is on Errigal up in Donegal, and the other is on Connachtna Dubber. And it's very hard to say, but they are two just absolutely stunning viewpoints. So hopefully the weather will be like this on Good Friday. And what a treat people are in store for, looking out to the Skellig Islands, the Blasket Islands, the Dingle Peninsula, the McGillicuddy's Reeks, and even over the Duncairns, and as far as the, we'll say, as the Cahar Mountains in Cork.
Tell us about the week itself, so go through it for us.
Yeah, well, on Good Friday, then it kicks off, and that's a good one for Kerry people if they want to do it. And all these paths, as well as that, have a passport, so you can get a stamp for complete.
We seem to have lost John there. I hope he isn't in some mountain now that he's that the reception is getting in the way. We'll get him back on the line. We got a message in here while we're talking about mountains and climbing and walking to say, could we say a huge congratulations to Marina Cahill from Listowel. She has reached base camp on Mount Everest. She did the hike to raise money for Kerry Hospice and Palliative Care for Ars Listowel. Well done from all her friends in Listowel and Mayo. And that's no easy feat. So well done indeed to Marina Cahill. If you want to get in touch with the programme, you can call us on 066-712-3666. You can text or WhatsApp 083-300-3300. We'll take a break and we'll get John G. O'Dwyer back on the line.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across the county. Serving the freshest seafood to Kerry families since 1963.
Yeah, I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. 066-712-3666. You can text WhatsApp 083-300-3300. We're talking to John G. O'Dwyer about Pilgrim Paths Week, which is taking place from the 3rd to the 12th of April. And John, as with all walking, you don't know where you could be or what the reception could be like, and you're always active, but we have you back on the line. I think we can hear you loud and clear. So you were saying...
I think we can. I can hear you certainly.
Perfectly. So, perfect. So you were saying you were starting the Good Friday there in Connachtna Dubber. So you can go on from there. Tell us about the week.
Yeah, that's it. Well, that's fantastic. And then, of course, the cross on the Nave. And that's not as much of a challenge to get up there. But again, it's beautiful. Of course, it's the Ryan's Daughter country. Absolutely drips with history. Of course, the Three Sisters on through Mount Brandon. So it goes from Ventry, where the Pilgrims have landed at Ventry Harbour, makes its way on across then to Galarus, Ardrey, Kilmal, Cader, the Galarus Castle as well as that, drips with history all along, and you know, it's not too challenging, 18 kilometres, and that's on then on Holy Saturday. But you also then have a guided walk up, as well as that. If any Kerry people are up in around Dublin, they could pop out to St. Kevin's Way, County Wicklow, and that's on Holy Saturday, April 4th. And all this is up. There's no point in boring the listeners with trying to give details,
yep.
But it's all up at pilgrimpath.ie. So then Good Friday, Canuck na Dobber, and then Holy Saturday, Cossáin na Naomh on the Dingle Peninsula, and also St. Kevin's Way, County Wicklow.
Very good. What advice would you have for people doing the week?
Well, what I'd say is it doesn't take an enormous amount of fitness. Obviously, there's somebody who would probably people who like to go for a walk. That's basically what you're talking about. And all of these, you needn't worry about them too much, because the thing is that they, you know, because they tend to be at low level. Now, apart from Canuck na Dobber, they tend to be at low level. So they cross roads. So if at any stage you felt that one of the things that's provided on Pilgrim Pass Week is they will have transport, so they'll pick you up. If you really feel you've gotten a blister or you can't go on or something has happened, they'll pick you up at one of the road crossings. And another one then I think is worth mentioning, because it's down there, is the 11th and 12th. It's a two-day walk, a beautiful walk, and maybe Kerry people might like to do it. It go over to Drimaleague and walk all the way to St. Finbar's Pilgrim Path. Follow St. Pilgrim's Pilgrim Path all the way to Googan Barra, and the descent into Googan Barra is fantastic. Again, a challenging walk. But they do cover it. There are, if you go through, you go over mountains, but you also go down into glens, and in the glens there are roads, and they have cars waiting in case somebody wasn't able or didn't want to go on.
Yeah, you have a great website actually, pilgrimpath.ie, and there's the Pilgrim Paths Week, there's a page for it, so it tells you the contacts that you can contact in relation to each walk, so that's very handy for people.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, people couldn't take it down, and it's very boring if I started doing that. And then, of course, nationwide, if you come up here then, as well as that, you have walks then, the Tohar Forest. You know, you talk about the Camino as being the kind of the well-known paths in Europe, but if you take the Tohar Forest, it's probably 1,000 years, goes back to pagan times, probably precedes the Camino by at least 1,000 years, about 2,000 years old, and had pagan origins that were then Christianized by the missionaries like St. Patrick. So tremendous tradition back along there. And if you're up in Donegal, there's a pilgrim walk up on Loch Derg there as well. And then if you come up here, then it's just a little bit outside of Pilgrim Paths Week, but you have then St. Declan's Way. And that's 115 kilometres. So you say, oh my God, to take that on. But they do it beautifully here, the community group. On the 18th and 19th, you go Cashel to Care, and then you go Care to Golden Bridge, cross the Knockwheel down mountains, then to Mount Mellery Abbey, which thankfully is reopening again. That's been in the news. And then on to Lismore. This lovely Georgian town of Lismore. Lismore to Eglish to Ardmore then on the 23rd and 24th. So over 3 weekends, again, the contacts are up at pilgrimpath.ie.
Yeah. Excellent.
So that's a lovely walk.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, John, thanks a million for coming on and telling us all about it, and best of luck with it. I think it's great to kind of have a focal point of a week as well. It just gives people a kind of a taster as well, and hopefully then they take it up kind of for the year as well. That's the 3rd to the 12th of April. And the, like John said there, pilgrimpaths.ie, and there's a page especially dedicated to Pilgrim Paths Week where you get all your information there. John Gio Dwyer, pleasure as always. Thanks a million for coming on. And enjoy the day, and enjoy out there in the fresh air. What a beautiful day we have across the county today. Now, next Saturday is Frank Lewis will be on, and he has a very special program. Gene Mangan, youngest ever Ross Talton winner and only ever winner of 4 consecutive Ross stages. And it's on from 9 to 11, March 28th, next Saturday. In my first Ross in 1969, Gene grabbed me and pulled me to the left, saving my life from running into a parking bollard. Fellow Clogden cyclist Pat Healy remembered in the square in Clogden, where Gene was given a superstar homecoming after winning the 1955 Ross Talton. His record as the youngest ever winner of the Ross as an 18-year-old still stands today, 71 years later. The life of Gene Mangan recorded at his special places in Clogden, presented by Frank Lewis. And throughout the programme, Frank is guided by Gene's cousin John Mangan, who won Ross Talton in 1972 and cycled competitively on the continent for 14 years. Frank is also joined by Jean's sister, Jill, who filled two big ledgers with paper cuttings of Jean's cycling years. Pow Grady remembers Jean cycling end to end on the rough parapet across Lone Bridge. Pat Healy also tells of Jean giving his bike in the 1958 Ross to Iron Man Mike Morfin. I was wondering what he'd be mentioned, who won the Ross that year. In 59, Jean cycled in France for 6 months. John Mangan says at the time, John was earning £26 as an apprentice electrician. In France, he earned £600 for a weekend cycling. Editor of the book on Ross Talton, Tom Daly, tells of Jean at the Rome Olympics in 1960. And Donald Mangan tells of his cousin Jean as a friend and a great man to get a car from. 92-year-old Barry O'Shea remembers going to the dances with Jean and her husband Jackie, and Jean bought his first bicycle from Jackie in preparation for the program on the phone from his home in Dublin. Jean's son Owen said Jean had no fear of dying. He told Owen, "I will meet all of the old biking friends." On that lovely sentiment, Mary O'Shea added, "He was the best and kindest friend." On the first anniversary of his passing, the many facets of the life of Jean recorded at his special place in Killorglin will be broadcast with Frank Lewis on Radio Kerry from 9 to 11am on Saturday, March 28, live on 96 to 98 FM and worldwide on radiokerry.ie. So that's going to be one not to be missed next Saturday morning from 9 a.m. Stay with us on the programme, because in the next hour we'll be speaking to Fiona Quirk about her experience of surviving cancer 3 times, and we'll also be remembering the late great Ronnie Delaney by playing excerpts of an interview I did with the legendary athlete in 2017. So we'll take a break, we'll have the news at 10, and I'll join you again in the next hour.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by the new family fish box at Quinlan's Seafood Bars. Packed with golden fish goujons, fresh squid, delicious prawns and tasty homemade chips. Order yours to take away today.
Now, so we're into the second hour of the Saturday Supplement. I'm Joe McGill. I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. A little later on, we are going to be playing you an interview I did from 2017 with the late, great Ronnie Delaney, who just passed away on the 11th of March. What a gentleman he was, and a legend in the sport of running. So we will be talking about him a little later on. But first, if you remember a few weeks ago, we did a very special programme about courage. And one person I interviewed as part of my interviews about courage was Fiona Quirk, a Tralee woman. And I interviewed her about her own personal journey with cancer, which she survived 3 times. So have a listen to this. I'm delighted to say now that I'm joined in studio by Fiona Quirk, who is from Tralee / London, and we'll clarify that now with Fiona. But Fiona has an amazing story to tell. She's overcome cancer 3 times, as well as associated health complications. So, Fiona, first, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
And thanks a million for telling your story, I'd imagine it isn't an easy story to tell, because you sent me a document during the week, just kind of, I suppose, the journey you've been on. And my God, what a journey. But we better clarify this, Tralee / London first.
Okay. My father was originally from Tralee, Casemans Avenue, and my mother was from Longford. And I was born in London and used to come back every summer. But when I turned 10, we moved to Tralee permanently. And then I left when I was 15, returned when I was 18, and went to Dublin. I was over for a few months, and then went back to England and returned in 21. And I'm not moving anymore after that. I'm done.
You're home now, sorry.
Yeah, originally Mideswell, now I'm Marion Park.
Right, so, excellent. Yeah. So let's talk about your cancer journey then. You were relatively young when you first got cancer.
Yeah, the first time I was 21, and it was Hodgkin's disease, which is a type of lymphoma cancer. So it was in my chest. I'd never heard of it before. So I ended up having 6 months of chemotherapy and a month of radiotherapy, which was every day for a month. So that was pretty grueling. And at the time, it was in the early 90s. So I didn't know anyone who had cancer. I was, you don't have social media now and people talking about it like you do now. Mm. So I really didn't have much, you know, information. So whatever a consultant told me, you know, I did whatever they told me to do. So I was very sort of, I'll do what I have to do just to get through it, because I was studying at the time. I was doing my Access Diploma in Humanities, which is like an equivalent to A-levels. Mm. So my plan then was to go to university. So that kind of messed that up a bit. So I had to leave, and then I went back and I got it. But it was a very difficult time, in the sense that, you know, suddenly people would like come up to you in the pub, oh, I heard you have cancer, and, you know, are you okay, blah, blah, blah. And I just was starting to feel that that's all that people associated you with. And I was with my ex-husband at the time, so he was only 20. And, like, our families, you know, they were very supportive. I had very supportive friends. But at the same time, I just had to kind of get on with it, because while I'm at home recovering, everyone's at work. So psychologically, I think it impacted on me more than I realised, but I didn't realise till years down the line. Mm-hmm. I was just like, have this treatment, stay alive, get it over and done with. And my naivety was that I thought, oh, once I finish the treatment, it's back to normal.
Mm.
It doesn't work like that.
Okay. But you know, when you are younger as well, you kind of think you're infallible a bit, don't you? You know, you're active, you're out there.
Yeah.
You're not hearing, like, when you get older, you're hearing more stories, more people around you are getting into difficult situations, more people, you lose more people the older you get.
Yeah,
but when you're younger, you're not even surrounded by, like, cancer or any of those stories.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I worked in perfumery. I used to go out on a Saturday night. I had a boyfriend. So I was like, what do you mean I got cancer? Like, this, you know, I had a lump on my neck, then I got a lump on the other side of my neck, and then I had breathing difficulties, had an x-ray, had blood tests, then I had a scan. Like, it all happened very quick, and then it was just like, oh, by the way, you got cancer. I'm like, excuse me? What do I do now?
Mm.
You know? So that was quite the shock of it as well. And plus, you are scared, am I going to die? And they said it was a stage 3. And the treatment, it was fairly tough, because I've inherited the worst veins ever. So I remember the nurses saying to me, I think we're going to have to hang you upside down to get blood from you. Because they have to check your bloods first.
Yeah.
So your red cells, your white cells and your platelets. So they have to be at a certain level before they can give you treatment.
Mm.
So that was always a bit of a worry. But, yeah, they used to laugh about, they used to call me the bat that we're going to have to hang you upside down. And sense of humour, you need a sense of humour about these things, because it was getting quite frustrating that people, you know, it's amazing how people come out of the woodwork, start sending you get well cards, and I'm like, oh, I've barely said hello to you.
Mm.
And when you get better, that's the only thing they'll talk to you about.
Yeah.
And it's not who I am.
Mm.
It's a part of my life that happened, and I dealt with it the best way I thought that I could and with what I had. And I just thought, well, we'll just, you know, that's done now. I'm fine.
Mm. And
so
in that first time you had Hodgkin's, how do you come out of that then? And, like, do they give you a clear bill of health, or what do they say
to
you?
Well, I used to have checkups every so many months, and then you'd have your yearly scans, blood tests and that sort of thing. So I wasn't on any medication after it. You know, I was on steroids for a while afterwards, but that was it. So just gradually, you know, they just kept an eye on me. But I did have some reactions to some of them. Like, you couldn't eat bananas. You couldn't have anything smoked, like smoked bacon. Or I had a really bad reaction to cherries. And I couldn't walk. It would impact on your legs. So I ended up having to take morphine. So there was a time that I had such a bad reaction that I had to roll out of my bed to slide down on my backside down the stairs to get a bottle of morphine, because I thought, right, this will do it, because I didn't want to wake anyone up.
Jeez.
So I remember sitting around with a bottle of morphine in my hand. I can laugh about it now, and I was like, is this what my life is now, drinking out of a bottle of morphine? But, you know, it did the trick, and then just you know, got on with the day.
But how did you get on with the day? Where do you find the strength now to get on with the day? Are you just treating every minute by minute, or how do you do that?
I think at the time I was just like, I'd have a week free in between each treatment. So that week I kind of looked as recovery. But I was, you know, I read a lot, and I was very lucky. I had very close friends that would come and see me. So I tried to, looking back, I probably masked a lot, which probably at the time helped, but I don't think in the long run it did, because people just presume you look well, your hair grows back, you know, you lose the weight, you're back working. They're, oh, she's fine. When really I wasn't, because I think internally I was struggling with, oh, I'm okay, but will it ever come back, you know? And if it does come back, what am I going to do? Because I met people that had the same condition and, diagnosis, and they died. I didn't. So...
Is there a guilt like with that?
Yeah, I think mine is more of a questioning. So why, you know, because I'm no sportswoman. I love chocolate. And at 21, you know, I could eat what I wanted. I didn't really think about food.
Yeah.
Like food now, you look on the back of a pack now.
Yeah, yeah.
So it didn't really impact on my life in that way. But like a lot of people I knew died. And that actually played on me quite a bit. And I suppose there was an element of guilt, but there was an element of, I'm being very lucky, really lucky. So, but I wasn't one of these people, oh, I'm going to grab life by both my hands and I'm going to do this and I'm going to... It didn't have that kind of impact on me.
Yeah.
It was
suppose, like, you get better, well,
yes,
inverted commas, and then it comes back again. So your fear was realised.
Well, I got it when I was 21. And then in 2019, I was 48, and I found a lump on my right breast. And I remember thinking, you've got to be joking. You have got to be joking. Because I'd had 20-odd years being cancer-free, and you get, I suppose, complacent, I guess. You just don't think, oh, I couldn't possibly get it again. So... went to the doctors. He said, right, we'll get you straight in. Had an ultrasound. They did a biopsy. And literally before I saw the surgeon, they said, yeah, there's definitely something there. So he said to me, okay, we are going to do a double mastectomy because of my history. And we'll do a reconstruction. So the reconstruction was from my stomach. Because I wasn't allowed implants.
Okay.
They just said you weren't a suitable candidate. So I said, that's fine. So that was 2019. And I went back to work after about 3 or 4 months. And the surgery itself, I mean, it was... It's kind of weird in a sense. You actually say goodbye to your breasts, because it's like this is never going to be the same again. So I think I found it very surreal, but I thought, you need to do this because they're not going to be the same. Things are going to change from tomorrow night when you have your op. So this will help you move forward, Fiona. So when I had the op, I was delirious for quite a few days, because I wasn't in pain, but you're just very, very sore, and everything feels very, very stiff. So the doctors are obviously constantly checking on you, because there is, in a 24-hour period, it's like you're hooked, it's like attached to under your arms. So if anything goes wrong, it would, you know, they would have to whip you back into surgery. So every sort of 2 hours I was woken up and they'd have to examine me. So I was just... You know, apparently I was very funny as far as the nurses were concerned, because apparently at one stage I woke up and asked one of the surgeons, like, why isn't Cillian Murphy here? He said he was going to come and see me. I have no recollection of this.
You were out of it,
but I was out of it.
Yeah.
And but I think, once again, a good sense of humour got me through it.
Yeah.
You know?
So the person that's 20 and the person that's in their 40s, are you able to take that news any better? Are you able to deal with it kind of with more maturity, or...?
I was more angry.
Yeah.
This time I was more angry, because it's like, come on, Yeah. What, you know, I thought I was eating healthy. I thought I was doing everything I was supposed to do, but mine was... obviously, I was going through the change, the menopause, I should say.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, this was estrogen that is what was the... was that the cause of it? So I'm on estrogen suppressants. Mm. So that's, you know, like, you're going through menopause and it's like, I can't stop that.
Yeah.
But obviously, it was one of the triggers. So I was kind of... that's what really made me mad.
Yeah. And who are you mad with? What are you mad with?
I suppose it would be God or some... I don't know. I was just mad.
Yeah.
Because I was like, but I've been cancer-free for over 20-odd years.
Are you mad with your body, if you know what I mean? Leaving you down?
Yeah, that could be, one way of looking at it because it's... You've no control.
Yeah.
Like, you think you've got a certain amount of control, but and you're trying to, you know, understand your hormones and, you know, if something... They clearly have a life of their own to some degree.
Yeah.
But once I had the op, I wasn't given chemotherapy. They said, actually, we don't think you need it. So I kind of got into food, really looked into food about, you know, carcinogenic food, you know, what we should eat, what we shouldn't eat. And I think that gave me a better understanding about how to help my body better because... You know. Let's be honest. There's a lot of crap out there that we eat. There's a lot of stuff in food that we don't even understand. Now, it's very easy to say, well, don't eat this, don't eat that, because some of it costs a lot of money and some of it is time. And obviously, I think unfortunately, I got it again 11 months later in the same breast. Then I... completely sort of shut down then. It was just like,
that's
a
knuckle blow.
Well, yeah, because I have a son.
Yeah.
He's 18 now. And I was like, how am I going to tell him now again?
Yeah.
Because as far as he's concerned, well, you've had the treatment, you've had medication, you've had an operation, so why would it be back? And I'm just like, I can't really even give you, nobody can really tell me that. So it was a partial mastectomy. And this time it was, I had to be sort of patched over from skin taken from the inside of my leg. And then they found one cancerous cell in my right armpit. So they took 13 cells out and one was cancerous. So I kind of look at that, if the breast cancer hadn't come back, what was in my armpit may not have been discovered until later, when a lump would have appeared, because there was no lump, and that's your lymphatic system, so it could have spread. So I kind of look at it, well, that kind of saved me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
So then I had to have chemo, and I was really upset because I said, I can't go through what I went through when I had Hodgkin's. And he said, my consultant was very good. He said, it will be not as bad as what you went through before. So I was like, okay. And then COVID arrived. Hooray!
Jeez.
So I was like, how am I going to do this? So, we went into... I was in England at the time. So lockdown was in April. I found the second lump in June. I had the op in July. And I started my chemo in September. So they put a Hickman line into my arm because my veins were so bad. Batwoman just couldn't deal with this again.
Yeah.
So I was like, great. They just syringe the medication into the tube and in it goes. So I had two of that. And then I got an infection in my arm, which resulted in sepsis. And
which is life-threatening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My arm just got very, very hot. It was actually my sister, Siobhan, that said, oh, that looks very warm for you. And I said, actually, yeah, I don't feel too great.
Mm.
And literally went to the hospital and they were like, right, bed now, isolation. So that was tough because my son, he could only see me from the bedroom door in the hospital and I missed his 12th birthday.
Wow.
So that was, once again, I don't like relying on people and asking people for help, but it was, I had to. You know, and people were very, you know, my friends and my family were great, but I just didn't, I didn't feel like I was there for him. And that was hard because I didn't really feel that sick. I was like, could I not go? Nope, you got to stay here. And then I went back home and for 10 days I had nurses coming to give me antibiotics 3 times a day. So I couldn't leave the house. So my son was in school because at the time I was working for the NHS. So he had that distraction. But it was, you know, I had no Hickman line. So once again, prodding at me, I mean, I felt like a pincushion. That's what, even now when I see, I mean, I'm just like, do what you've got to do. Doesn't bother me. But it's like you're praying they'll get a vein.
Yeah.
Because they were getting very frustrated. I mean, they were doing it in my foot at one stage.
My God.
So I just thought, right, I just have to grin and bear this.
Mm.
But by this stage, I was far more on top of my diet. And I think that definitely helped me through this time.
That's the first part of the interview I did with Fiona Quirk. We're going to hear more from her after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Enjoy a simple, healthy and easy dinner solution with Quinlan's fresh, ready-made seafood meals available in store.
Now let's return to the second half of the interview I did with Fiona Quirk. We were talking to Fiona as part of a series we did on courage, and Fiona has survived cancer 3 times, and we spoke to her about this experience. How are you now?
I'm good. I'm grand. You know, I'm 6-7 years clear now, nearly. So I just have my yearly checkup. I go to Cork, and you know, I have my blood test, and I'm fine. You know,
is it something that's like that 21-year-old? Is it in the back of your head, kind of all the time, or? Is it a shadow like behind you, or?
I think I'm a lot more in tune with my body now that I don't take it for granted. If you're not feeling right, or if this isn't, then I'll go down to the doctor. I'm not a hypochondriac, by the way.
Yeah.
But I'm very more into supplements, vitamins, where food comes from.
But that sounds like you're proactive rather than reactive. You're taking control.
Yeah, and that's what's important. I think people need to realise that when I got ill, you know, with breast cancer twice, I was able to say to the consultant, you know, because during COVID, I had to have the treatment on my own. Nobody could come into the ward with you. And I was able to decide, this is what I want to eat. This is what I want to drink. I asked, you know, exactly what was in the chemo. You know, what should I eat before? What should I eat after? I did fast. And I'm not saying people should do this, but I fasted before I had my treatment and I fasted afterwards. And that, for me, helped an awful lot.
Mm.
I think I recovered quicker. But, I felt more in control. As upsetting as it was, obviously, I had a child, I was a single mum, there was COVID, there was money worries. I did feel more in control compared to that 21-year-old that just went, yes, doctor, no, doctor, whatever you want me to do.
Mm.
Because I read lots of books. I followed dietitians on Instagram. And that definitely helped me through.
Mm.
Definitely. Because there's so much out there that you can do for yourself. But I think you have to do it.
Yeah, we're out of time. But just in relation to, we're talking about bravery,
mm-hmm.
resilience and courage, and it seems to me you have these in abundance. Like, obviously, maybe you'd no choice in the matter as well,
that you had to be brave.
But like, it sounds to me like you've built up your resilience and you've taken control. You know, like something like cancer can be a bombshell and it can take all the control out of you. Think, I've no control over it. But it seems to like you've taken, to the extent that you can, control over your life.
Yeah, I think. Now, I wouldn't consider myself brave or courageous. I made a choice to have treatment. I made a choice to have, you know, the operations. And people need to know, you have a choice. I didn't particularly want to have the chemo again. I tried to wriggle out of it. And the consultant said, you've got 2 years if you don't have it, Fiona. And I was like, okay, I give in. But the eating, I had more control over, and I firmly believe that helped me. So when you've got control, it gives you resilience. I'm not particularly competitive, but I know I'm very resilient. And I've had other things go on in my life that the resilience has stood by me, you know, and resilience comes in different forms. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, you're resilient because you can climb Carrin Toohill 10 times in a year. Resilience comes with, I'm able to get up in the morning, I'm able to look at myself in the mirror, and I can go ahead with my day. And if it comes up in conversation about the cancer, I don't have to feel embarrassed. I don't have to feel, oh, this isn't interesting, or nobody wants to know. I don't feel the shame of it anymore, or and I know it's only a part of me. It's not all of me, you know, so...
That's great advice for young people
Thank
listening
you.
In, isn't it?
I hope yeah, so, yeah. I hope so.
It is, you
I
know, for
so.
Anything they're dealing
yeah.
with, mm. that it mm-hmm. doesn't define you now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fiona, thanks a million. It's a pleasure talking to you, and thanks a million for telling your story.
No problem, Joe. It's my pleasure.
That's Fiona Quirk there, and I want to thank her for doing the interview and doing it so eloquently and honestly as well. And we wish her continued good health and success into the future. We're going to take a break, and after that, we're going to be remembering the late, great Ronnie Delaney.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Take the fear out of fish and chat to our fishmongers about how to add delicious, easy-to-cook seafood into your menu. Oven and air fryer-ready meals available.
Now, on Wednesday, the 11th of March, legendary Olympic 1500-metre champion Ronnie Delaney died at the age of 91. And Ronnie cemented his place in sporting history when he won gold in the 1500 metres at the 1956 Summer Olympics. Just 21 years old at the time, the Arklow-born runner produced one of the most memorable performances in Irish Olympic history, unleashing a powerful late sprint to win in an Olympic record time of 3 minutes and 41.2 seconds and secure Ireland's first Olympic track and field gold medal. Born in Arklow, County Wicklow, and raised in Dublin, Delaney first rose through the ranks with Crusaders Athletic Club. He later moved to the United States to study at Villanova University, where he developed into one of the leading collegiate middle distance runners of his generation, capturing several NCAA championship titles. Among his other major achievements was a bronze medal in the 1500 metres at the 1958 European Athletics Championships, part of a highly successful period on the international athletics circuit. In 1961, he won gold in the 800 metres at the Summer Universiade in Sofia. Now, persistent injuries eventually forced Delaney to retire later that same year at the age of 26. The announcement came on the same day he revealed his engagement to his future wife, Joan Reardon. Delaney moved to Sandymount when he was 6 years old and later studied commerce at Villanova University in the United States, where he trained under renowned track coach Jumbo Elliott. Away from competition, Delaney remained closely involved in Irish sport and supported the development of future generations of athletes, and the Athletics Ireland website paid tribute to him there in their article. Now, I interviewed Ronnie Delaney when he was down visiting Kells Bay Gardens in April 2017. So have a listen to this interview with Ronnie about his career. Ronnie, firstly, thanks a million for talking to me and welcome to Kerry. You're no stranger to this place.
Yeah, I was just thinking, and thank you for your welcome. I love coming to Kerry. I was just thinking, the first time I ever came down here was 1955, and I had an old, not quite Y model Ford, but the maximum speed it could do was 40 miles an hour. And I stayed not in the Butler Arms, but would it be the Sea View? I think it might have been owned by a famous Mick O'Dwyer at the time.
Might so the lodge, the seed.
Yeah, and then the posh people stayed in the Butler Arms, which I'm sure is still there. So I was travelling in the company of posh people who were up in the Butler Arms, so I was down the equally nice Sea View. So I do remember that, because my grandfather died when I was down here, and I had to drive back home on my own in this almost Y model Ford. It was the old square Ford. Max, my father, he was treated like a baby. It was his car. And the first thing he'd do when I'd come back with the car, he'd check the oil. And, of course, I'd have run every drop of oil out of it, every drop of water. No wonder my father got cross with me occasionally.
And that's the time Waterville was bouncing then. You know, it was very affluent that time.
Yeah, well, see, the big thing then was fishing. Mm. And the huge customers who are still there, I'm sure, are the English. And the Butler Arms had this sort of aura about it. And all of Kerry had this beautiful aura about it. But they used to come to fish. And then laterally, I think it became the golf. There was a golf course there at the time. I'm not sure if it was the same course. Mm. And then, of course, you had this famous American who built another hotel, and he did some sort of other business, which I think might have been related to marine science and marine farming. So this incredible history in my lifetime. I mean, 1955, that was, what, 61 years ago. My lifetime, all of this change, all this dramatic change. And then, of course, the beauty of Kerry is what is exemplified today, and my being here in Kells Bay Gardens is, I suppose, all about that.
Yeah, and you brought the sunshine with you. I was looking at your race again, and I don't know, are you sick of going through the famous race in Melbourne, or like, because last it was December 1st, so it's over 60 years yeah, yeah. Since then, are the memories as vivid as ever?
Oh, the memories are totally enhanced. I'm much better now than I was then, and The vividness of it is even better today, because high technology, digitalization, the film is far better. For centuries, it seems, on RTE, they used to do this sports program and they showed a black and white film of my race. It was like the Keystone Cops. So nowadays you have a contemporary film, and it's beautiful digitalized colour. The commentator is Australian. We used to have Brendan O'Reilly, Lord Rest His Soul, dubbing over the race, and he didn't get half the names right. We wouldn't be able to pronounce Rossivalgi or Young. So I have hysterical memories of that. So my contemporary memories are of the race in great clarity. And of course, in my mindset, I have the race. The race will always be there, the tactics, what I did, what I didn't do. They're always there in my head, but they're enhanced by today's analysis. And I'm not going on too much, I hope, Joe, but the actual analysis of the race is far more detailed today. Your profession, the media, the print journalists, they analyse it with a stopwatch. So I always knew I ran a very fast last lap. I ran 54 seconds for 400 metres, or a quarter of a mile, which was very fast. But the analysis of that last lap, I really didn't begin to run hard until maybe 300 metres out. And now someone like Ina Reardon of The Times or Frank Greeley of Irish Runner will say to me, you know, you ran the last 300 metres in 38 seconds? And I say, yeah, what does that mean? And then he'd say to me, you ran the last 100 metres in 12 seconds. So apparently I was absolutely flying. But that's fascinating as well, for me to be able to look at the race now and know I haven't moved, knowing I ran 54 seconds, and then someone tells you you ran 38 seconds for the last 300 metres. And what it means is that I would be competitive in any sort of a moderately paced race today, because very few last laps have been as fast as that. So I would be competitive, say, have been competitive in 1992 in Barcelona, where a man called Cacho won it, a Spaniard. And he won it like I won it. He won it because he could sprint. And I could sprint. So my sort of makeup, physiology, my heart, everything like that must have been geared where I could switch gears and run like a jackrabbit at the end.
But I was looking at it now, and for, say, someone that doesn't know anything about running, it was an unbelievably exciting race, because it looked like you were languishing away there in the back. But of course, that was tactics, and you timed your run, the famous phrase of timing a run. But you just went in all of a sudden, went through the runners nice and calmly as well, and kind of caught them as well. And you'd like favourites like John Landy was the real home favourite, wasn't he? So there was a lot of big runners in the race as well.
Yeah, that's a very nice observation, because I did. The fact about that is that, say, there was only 12 metres between first and last. I was about 10th through the preliminaries. And then the race begins at the bell. And at the bell, there was 6 metres between 12 men. Poor Al Hewson, my dear friend Brian Hewson, he had unfortunately found himself in the lead, which he didn't want to be in, I was comfortable making my way through, trailing John Landy. So I really, as you quite incisively as observed, I didn't make my move till about the back straight, and then I made this dramatic move. But your mindset was, and the training you had, I was a racer. I wasn't a clock man. I loved to race. I loved to beat the other guy. I got a sense of winning and aggressiveness coming when you're going by someone. So my tactics was to make this one dramatic move. So therefore, the preliminary, we were practically jogging. And my mindset, all I was saying was, relax, relax, relax. My coach would have been shouting that at me every day on the track, relax, relax. And even though I wasn't a particularly attractive runner, not facially, but physiologically, I wasn't that much of a stylist. In my own mind, I had the most beautiful running action in the world. I was the smoothest runner in the world, and I was so relaxed that I didn't even think I was expending any energy. So there are extraordinary sort of memories still 61 years after.
Sports psychology is such a massive thing today, you know. It's been mentioned across all sports. But your coach, Jumbo Elliott, the famous famous coach, he thought you to run past the tape, to visualise the tape in winning. So that was unbelievable positivity, wasn't it?
That's even funnier, because the other coach who had an influence on my career at the time was from the University of California, because I trained the last week. And while Jumbo had you visualising, they say, yeah, had you winning, he wanted you to win. The slogan on the wall was win or bust. He didn't come over and embrace you because you got second or third, and he didn't give you plaudits because you got first. He just felt that was what you had to do. And then if you think about the team I had was, we had, in my time there, we had three Olympic champions. In the history of Irish track, we have three Olympic champions. Charles Jenkins, Olympic 400 metre champion. Don Bragg, Olympic pole vault champion. And here, three contemporary Olympic champions. And the other guys on the team, we'd only about a 6 or 7 man team. The other guys were world record holders at 60 yards indoors. We'd almost a 7 foot high jumper. What a phenomenal place to be. But just to go back to the humorous side, the American coach, Brutus Hamilton, I was working out under his care when I was down in California before going to Australia. And he says to me, just say, go up the track, Ronnie. I go up the track and I says, run. He goes across and he puts a tape across the finishing line. Now he said, run through the tape, Ronnie. So I go along with the game and I run through the tape, arms outstretched, face jubilant in joy. And he comes over and he puts his arm around me paternally and he says, Ronnie, now we have practiced everything, even breaking the tape. Now, that was the American bullshit. Listeners, I apologise. But that was the American bullshit that I had to survive with. Because basically, I just was a racer. Instinctively, I wanted to race. Instinctively, I wanted to beat the other man. I got that in Ireland. I got that from my early influences in Ireland, the coaches who helped me when I was maturing. Because I only began to run when I was 17 years of age.
But that's what I was going to ask you. Was it always running for you? So obviously it wasn't.
No, I wasn't. I was actually a tennis player, a rugby player, a hockey player. Previously I'd played a bit of Gaelic. I'd never played hurling. And I could actually do things like lawn bowls, because the environment I lived beside Railway Union Cricket Club, Monkstown Rugby Football Club, Claremont Lawn Tennis Club, and I had these opportunities to play all these sports. But I discovered when I was about 17, I knew I was a good runner, but I was only a good runner. I knew I could run because I won the Leinster Colleges, the All-Ireland Colleges, and, you know, when I was 17, you maybe did a week's training and you went along, you had no tracksuit, and you beat these other guys. But then suddenly when I was 18, I was asked to run against men. And I think I was playing in the Irish Tennis Championships in Fitzwilliam. And I left the Tennis Championships and retired. I was probably beaten. And I went off and ran against this man. And I was the first Irishman to break 2 minutes for a half mile. And that was at 18 years of age. So then I suddenly realised, I can run. I have an enormous gift. And I had the intelligence to recognise that. The Gooch, the wonderful Gooch, he was a phenomenon right through his life mentally, like being the patron of the team or the mascot, and then developing into this extraordinary athlete. I had that gift, and I saw it when I was 18 years of age, and then I gave everything else up, and then I began focusing, how good can I become? And I took many key decisions in my life. So the other thing I should mention, and it's in the sense of gratitude, my genes were extraordinary because my brother Joe was a better runner than I was.
Go ahead.
At school. He was Irish long jump champion, men's and youths at the same time. He held the long jump record for the Leinster Colleges for, say, 30 years. He could win the high jump, the long jump and a sprint. He was 400-metre Leinster champion. He was a phenomenal athlete, but then he was bored. He was a great athlete from when he was 12. And because he ran so much, by the time he was 18, he was sick and tired of it. And he gave up. He never ran anymore, except once. I was running in the Irish Champs. At this stage, I was becoming the great athlete. Mm. And I insisted on him joining the championships. And he hadn't played for 4 years, hadn't run for 4 years, trained or anything, but he was playing field hockey. And I said, Joe, you have so much natural ability. You'll win the Irish Championships. And I said, then we'll travel together to England, to Scotland, to Wales, as part of the Irish team. He came down, and we're on our way down to Irishtown Stadium. It's a cinder track. And the way down, he's giving out hell to me. What'd you do this to me for? And he's my older brother. So he says, God, Ronnie, said, I'd love a pint. At Clark's was the local pub. So I said, OK, Joe, one pint. But only one pint. One pint, I said, will help you. It'll sharpen your reactions. If you have two, you're banjacks. You won't be able to run. You won't be able to jump. I said, just go and have your one pint. He had his one pint. He got one jump off, won the Irish Championship. And we went, this is a shameful thing to say, but this is the time. We went to internationals all over Scotland, Edinburgh, London, Wales, Cardiff. And he never put a tracksuit on or a pair of shoes on between internationals. So talk about chariots of fire.
That's a great story.
Yeah, what a lovely way of speaking Ronnie Delaney had. We're going to hear more from Ronnie after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Supplement your diet with a healthy and fresh dinner option. Fresh seafood from Quinlan.
Now let's return to the interview I did in 2017 with Ronnie Delaney, who just passed away on the 11th of March last.
When we were younger, we used to run around the dunes in Waterville and training, because we've often heard back that Ronnie Delaney used to train here. So if it was good enough for Ronnie Delaney, it was definitely going to be good enough for us. Is that true?
And that is a marvellous story. And I would have heard that years and years later. Apparently the eyes of Kerry were on this skinny, lanky guy running like a madman around the beach and the dunes. And apparently one famous Kerry coach saw all this, and of course I've credited with the phenomenal development of Kerry football, which is probably a load of nonsense, but I allegedly was the change mentor for that. Now the reality is these stories grow. So the story has grown, so probably the influence of it is much greater now. A bit like I do press-ups and chin-ups, and when I was doing them in any sort of public forum, say, with eyes looking at me, what is the sleeping valley of the sleeping eyes? And they'd be looking at me, they see me doing chin-ups and press-ups. And I could do endless of them, but now it's hundreds. The myth is Ronnie Delaney could do 100 press-ups, and he could do 50 pull-ups, and then he'd do another 50. The myth of the Olympian is... I adore it. It's great.
What's the secret yourself, Ronnie? You're very healthy and lively and fit. Like, is it happiness? Or is it that bit of blending the exercise and all that?
Yeah, I think the exercise is very simple. I wouldn't be a devotee of training. Mm. I wouldn't be a devotee of getting your heart beat up. But I would be a devotee of what I call lifestyle. And lifestyle to me is moderation. I mean moderation in your lifestyle. Don't be stressing yourself. Eat well, sleep well. I like a jar. Have a good few jars. But do it all within a controlled sort of framework. And I suppose the gift then is of your environment. So I was very lucky. I married a lovely lady. We're still happily married. Well, I'm happier than she is, I'm sure. And we're 54 years married.
Congratulations.
You have the gift of children. We had 4 children. And then I have 15 grandchildren. And I'm a wealthy man, you know. I mean, what value can you put on that? My family all live in proximity to us. I can walk to their homes. I mean, at 80-something years of age, what joy. I also like working. I like using my... Oh, the other thing I think is terribly important, since you asked me that question, I think is to exercise your mind. Mm. So I exercise my mind every day. I go into an office environment every day. I have to manage Ronnie Delaney, the iconic person who has to do all these different things. So managing him takes time, say that objectively. But also I do exercise, mind exercise. So I'd love doing crosswords. I'd love watching University Challenge. And Sir Tim Smith, who's here this weekend, he was on University Challenge. He is so bright, he was on the programme. And I love watching that. So I love exercising my mind. I'd love to read more, but I don't have the energy or the time to read. Maybe when I'm older, I'll read.
Yeah, Ronnie Delaney there. And to this date, it's one of my favourite interviews I conducted, because he was so welcoming, no airs or graces. And we were talking well before the interview and well after the interview as well. I really enjoyed my time with him, and our sympathies to his family and friends and neighbours and all in the athletics world. May he rest in peace. Now, in focus, our theme is Ireland's call for you to send your photos to. And we were lamenting how the weather was so bad for your spring theme photos. Well, the weather is picking up now, so you can get more of those great photos. Ireland's call, it can be whatever interpretation. Maybe you got some great photos around St. Patrick's Day. Maybe it was cheering on the rugby. Or maybe it is what Ireland means to you. It's Ireland's call. So send those photos to Jay McGill at radiokerry.ie before midday Wednesday, before the first Saturday of the month. Now, that's all we have time for on the programme this morning. Thanks a million for tuning in. And thanks to Abigail Bernard, who is on sound. Pat Kelly is on the way, so keep it here on Radio Kerry. I'll be back again in 2 weeks' time. Frank is on next Saturday, as I mentioned earlier. So until then, look after yourself and take care.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Because at least one day of the weekend should involve someone else doing all the cooking. Order your delicious takeaway from Quinlan's today.